All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Well, everyone who's here. So this morning I will be in 1 Samuel chapter 14. And I'm going to go ahead and read our passage for us this morning. So 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 1. One day Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men, including Ahihah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on one side and a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sinna. One crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Geba. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." And his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you heart and soul." And then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them. And if they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still on our place, and we will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand. And this shall be a sign for us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, "Look, Hebrews are coming out of their holes, with which they have hidden themselves." And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, "Come up to us, and we will show you a thing." And Jonathan said to his armor-bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." And then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor-bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer killed them after him. And at that first and that first strike which Jonathan and his armor bearer made killed about 20 men within as it were a half a furrow's length in an acre of a land. And there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison, even the raiders, trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the magnitude was dispersing here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with them, "Count and see who has gone from us." And when they counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said to Ahiah, "Bring the ark of God here, for the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel." Now while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult came into the camp of the Philistines, increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into battle. And behold, every Philistine sword was against his fellow, and there was a great confusion. Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in the battle. And so the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven. And the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day. So Saul had laid an oath on the people, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged of my enemies." So none of the people had tasted food. Now when all the people came to the forest, behold, there was honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, the honey was dropping. But no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father's charge. His father charged the people with the oath. So he put on the tap of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. Then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have become bright because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today the spoil of their enemies that they found. For now the defeat among the Philistines has not been great." They struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ahilon, and the people were very faint. The people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a great stone to me here." And Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to him, 'Let every man bring his ox and his sheep and slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.'" So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, and they slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he had built to the Lord. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seemed good to you." But the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. And Saul said, "Come here, all you leaders of the people, and know and see how this sin has arisen today. For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die." But there was not a man among all the people who answered them. Then he said to all of Israel, "You shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said, "O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If this guilt is in me or in Jonathan, my son, O Lord God of Israel, give Urim. But if this guilt is in the people of Israel, give Thummim." And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. And then Saul said, "Cast this lot between me and my son Jonathan." And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." And Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the tip of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I will die." And Saul said, "God do so to me, and more so also. You shall surely die, Jonathan." Then the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die? Who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it, as the Lord lives, there shall not be one hair on his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people ransomed Jonathan, so that he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. When Saul had taken kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab and against the Ammonites, against Edom and against the king Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. He did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hand of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchisha. And the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn Merib, and the name of the younger Michal. And the name of son's wife was Ahinom, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or valiant man, he attached himself to himself. Well, that is our text this morning in 1 Samuel 14. Quite a lengthy text for us. So I want to set up the scene for our passage this morning and briefly revisit what Elias taught in chapter 13. So at the beginning of chapter 13, if you remember, Saul and Jonathan divided up their forces to go and fight the Philistines. Jonathan defeats the Philistines at Gibeah. And if you remember, Saul boasted of this defeat as though the credit was for him to take. When the Philistines heard news of this defeat, they mustered a large-scale counterattack against Israel. And at this point, Israel realizes that this counterattack is much larger and much greater than Israel's. They have no weapons other than their plows and chairs, and so they're severely outnumbered and outweaponed. And in response, Israel does not seek the Lord's guidance, nor do they show any faith in Him. But they allow the fear to overtake them, and they scatter. Some hide, some of Israel hides, and the few that remained become paralyzed by fear. Inaction to them was the best course of action to take. And so we see the response in verses 6 and 7 of chapter 13. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. Some Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. And Saul was at Gilgal, and the people followed him, trembling. You know, to Israel's credit, their fear of being hard-pressed was not completely unwarranted. As Elias pointed out last Sunday, Israel was more of a militia than it was a trained army. And the Philistines had control of the blacksmith trade and prevented Israel from gaining any weaponry advantage over them. So from a human perspective, the odds of defeating an army of this magnitude and strength was close to impossible. A situation like this would make anyone afraid. But it's these types of situations that God specifically uses to display His strength. Situations that reveal how weak and incapable we are. I say that Israel's fear was not completely unwarranted because God specifically ordained this situation to show them that their strength was not within themselves to go and overtake the Philistines. God wanted to expose His strength through them and to expose their weakness in them. God wanted Israel to put their faith in Him, and after all, hasn't Israel been in situations like this before? God miraculously delivered them from Egypt, and they're between a rock and a hard place, between the Red Sea and between the Egyptian army, and they have nowhere to go. The only thing that's going to deliver them is God, and God saved them. They knew that within that spot that they were in, they were facing death, and God delivered them from that death. And so God wanted them to be afraid so that their fear would drive them back to the Lord rather than allowing their fear to paralyze them. And so the theme of our passage this morning is that nothing can hinder the Lord, for He is able to do far more abundantly than what we ask or think. And so I see our text divided up into five sections. The first five verses shows us the inaction of Saul. From verses 6 to 23, we see the faithful action of Jonathan. Verses 24 through 35, we see the sin of Saul. verses 36 through 46, 36 through 46, the silence of God and the vindication of Jonathan. And then lastly, in verses 47 through 52, we see the legacy of Saul. So when the Philistines regathered for a counter-assault against Israel, they surrounded Israel on three sides. And they're in this mountainous territory where you have one mount on one side which is called the Crag in our text, and another mount on the other side, and in between is a valley. And so at this point, Saul is in a place where he's having to make a decision about his next move. Him and his 600 men are hiding in this cave, and he's having to make this decision of what he's going to do in this time. And what he doesn't do is seek the Lord's guidance about what he should do. So in the opening verses, the author creates this juxtaposition between Saul's decision and then Jonathan's. And so Saul and his 600 men decide they're going to retreat to the outskirts of Gibeah. The ESV reads that Saul was staying inside of a pomegranate cave, but that's not exactly what the Hebrew text is communicating. What's being communicated is that Saul was sitting under a pomegranate tree. And so the New King James communicates this accurately. But why is this important? The author is trying to convey the message that Saul had basically given up, that he is sitting down on his duties as being the shepherd and the leader of Israel, and he's given up. He has nowhere to go, and so at this point, they're just going to hide and hope that the conflict will just resolve itself on its own. Interestingly, he had a priest of the Lord with him. He had every opportunity to go and seek the Lord's guidance in this time. The purpose of the priest was to instruct the king in the way of the Lord, telling him what God is supposed to do for them. And Saul doesn't even consult the Lord in this matter. And also, interestingly, is the lineage of this priest. So his name is Ahiah, if that's really how you pronounce it. But this priest was just as incompetent as Saul in our text. And so the author's intention by providing this lineage is to show us that this priest here is the son, is the grandson of Phinehas, who was the cursed priest and the rebellious son of Eli. And so this priest is from this cursed lineage, from the heritage of Phinehas. The two men that God appointed to bring spiritual leadership in Israel, they have abdicated their role as God's earthly shepherd for his people. Now, in contrast to Saul, Jonathan makes a decision to go and attack the Philistines, and he brings his armor bearer with him. Our text communicates in these first two verses that he didn't tell his father when he went. So in chapter 14, it says, "One day Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side.' But he didn't tell his father. And the appearance of this decision seems to be foolish. And especially in warfare, to launch an attack against your enemy without the knowledge and the approval of your superiors would be considered an act of rebellion. And so Jonathan is here, and he takes his armor bearer to go with him to attack these Philistines. And his father doesn't even know about this. But as we see here in a minute, that Jonathan's action was not an act of rebellion, but an act of submission to the Lord. I think he saw his father's sin. He saw his father's lack of willingness to go and submit himself to the Lord. And he's not going to be involved in that sin. He knew that this problem would not go away, and that's Jonathan. Sitting was not going to solve it, so he took action to address it. Not in his own strength, but in the strength of the Lord, he feared God rather than man. And so, there are times, and I don't know what circumstances you all are facing, sometimes the Lord provides circumstances that, one, we have no control over, circumstances that seem to be overwhelming, circumstances that require for us to make a decision about what we're going to do and how we're going to face it. Sometimes these circumstances can be conflict with someone else. Sometimes it can be as simple as the Lord has given us an opportunity to go and share the gospel to this person, but we don't. So it can be as big or as small as something as those things. And sometimes we get tempted to run away. Sometimes we get tempted to hide, at hoping that the conflict will go away on its own. But we know it never does. And we're having to ask God, Lord, I need to submit myself to you. I am afraid. I don't know how to respond. And in those moments of fear, those moments of fear are good. God uses that to bring us back to Him, to show that He's in control of the situations that we face in this life. And we have no inability, we have no strength of our own to go and do things and fix things the way we want them to. But God has a greater plan always for us. Our faith is supposed to be grounded in who God is in these times. And we will see that in the faithful action of Jonathan in verses 6 through 23. So look with me at these verses, starting in verse 6. Jonathan goes and attacks the Philistines. And in verse 6 he says, Jonathan, come. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor bearer, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. So let me stop there for a minute. Jonathan's telling his armor bearer to come with him. It's just the two of them against a whole garrison of the Philistines. And so I think Jonathan is under no illusion that them two alone has no power to overtake a whole garrison of the Philistines. He's under no illusion that he has this mighty strength within him to go out and accomplish this mission just by themselves, them two. So I'm reminded of a scene in the movie The Patriot when Mel Gibson and his son, they go and attack a troop of the British who are walking in the midst of these woods, and you have Mel Gibson and his son shooting at them and running through the woods as a type of guerrilla warfare. And they go and overtake this troop of the British Army. They end up killing a lot, and they lay down their arms. And anyways, the movie is trying to highlight the strength and the independence of these men to go and accomplish what no man could typically do. And in contrast to the image of Hollywood, Jonathan was fully aware that they were outnumbered and outweaponed and fully expecting that their lives could end at this point. They were going into this camp of the Philistines fully expecting and fully willing to lay down their lives. And I think we see that when he makes this statement, it may be that the Lord will work for us. So what does he mean by may? What does he mean by it may be that the Lord will work for us? Well, I don't think he's saying that God may or may not help them depending on the mood that he's in. So if he's in if he's in a just in a bad mood today, you know, I don't think I'm going to help you today. But maybe he's in a good mood, and maybe he'll just, okay, you know, I'm going to be gracious to you today. I'm going to help you and fight for you. That's not the type of mentality that Jonathan is having. And so when he's saying that it may be that the Lord will work for them, what he's saying is that even if they succeed or even if they fail, God is still going to accomplish his work of salvation. God's on his throne. He's in control. The outcome is in his hands and not in ours. And so I think when we're facing situations, we have to remember God's the one who determines the outcome of the situations in our lives. We don't. We may go and seek forgiveness and repentance, but it may not change the heart of the other person we're talking to. And so we have to give that person up into the Lord's hand. And the working of their hearts is in his hand and not in ours. The success of this mission was not dependent upon their effort or their strength. Success is defined by God's work, and his plan will always succeed. It will never be thwarted. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were faced with death of being thrown into the fiery furnace for not bowing down to King Nebuchadnezzar's image, this is how they respond to the king. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods nor worship the golden image which you have set up. They knew full well, just as Jonathan did, that their act of submission to the Lord and their faith in him could cost them their lives, and fully expecting and willing to go through with it. But they also knew that in the face of death, God is able to deliver them from this death that they're facing. But even if he doesn't deliver them, he will ultimately deliver them, because they know that death in this life is not all there is. There is a life beyond this life that they had looked forward to. And so back into our text, Jonathan's basis for his faith is believing that it may be that the Lord will work for them. Jonathan's faith in believing that it may be that the Lord will work for them is grounded in what he says next. Namely, that nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. That's where his faith is grounded. There is no situation too big for God to handle. Many situations are too big for us to handle. And it definitely is not up to us to accomplish God's work of salvation. He doesn't need us. He can save and he can deliver with or without me. He doesn't need my work. So he's not hindered by the little we have to offer, nor is he hindered by our inability to accomplish what's before us. So with this in mind, let me tell you about one of the greatest success stories of God's work of salvation. You know, in the face of the certainty of death upon the cross, Jesus tells the Pharisees in John 2:19, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Christ knew that he was headed to the cross. He knew that he was facing a certainty of death. But he also knew that this death would not be final. He knew that this death would accomplish God's work of salvation, and he would be risen from the grave 3 days later. And so this temple, Christ's body, was destroyed upon the cross. God used his son's death, which in the eyes of men was one of the greatest failures in human history, to accomplish what is one of the greatest success stories in human history, the redemption of his people, salvation for all who put their faith in him. And Christ was risen on the third day to set this in stone. Challenging situations are going to come in our lives. Suffering is going to come into our lives. And so what we are being faced with is an opportunity to respond in faith. We're all given the opportunity to respond, and we must, and God is showing us, okay, so where are you going to place your faith today? Do we believe that even if our plans fail, God uses all of these failures and our weaknesses and our inabilities for our good and for his glory? That though we fail, God will always succeed, even in our failures. And that is the basis of our faith in this trial-filled life. And you know, this faith is contagious. We see somebody else who stands up and has this kind of faith, and it makes us to want to have that same faith. Jonathan's faith, his faithful action, was contagious. It moved within his armor bearer to have that faith with him, to the point that his armor bearer now is willing to die by his side. It mobilized his armor bearer to action, the faith that Jonathan had in the Lord. And it mobilized all of Israel to come out of hiding. It mobilized Saul and his 600 men to go and attack these Philistines that Jonathan and his armor bearer did with just between the two of them. It mobilized a whole force to go and attack these Philistines. And that's what we see in verses 24 through 35. No, that's not what we see in verses 24 through 35. We see that in verses 6 through 24. So one of the means that God uses to strengthen our faith and mobilize to action is by the faith of others in our own lives. And it's part of the reason why Hebrews chapter 11 is written, to embolden and to strengthen our faith. And so as we move on into our text, we look at verses 24 through 35, and the author provides this juxtaposition between Jonathan's faithful action and the sinful action of Saul. Verse 24 says this, "And the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day. So Saul had laid an oath on the people, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged on my enemies.' So none of the people had tasted food." You know, it seems rather odd, after had been hard-pressed in battle, that Saul would impose an oath of abstinence from food. The one thing that God provides for their strength and nourishment, Saul's placing an oath for them not to partake of. Now, why was he imposing this oath? Well, our text says this, "Cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged upon my enemies." So Saul's purpose is that he doesn't want to waste any time by stopping for food and attacking the Philistines. He wants to maximize his time and his efforts to go and accomplish vengeance upon his enemies and to get revenge over the people that had oppressed Israel. That's Saul's motivation. He's putting his own desires for vengeance above the needs of his people. But interestingly, this oath causes the opposite effect of what Saul intended. For what could have been a major victory is now hindered and cut short because of Saul's selfishness. Not only that, but Saul's sin causes his own people to sin as well. For it says, starting in verse 31, they struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash in Ahilon. Then the people were very faint. The people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground. And the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And so if you're paying attention, you might be asking yourselves, where is God in all of this? Where is God in Saul's decision? Where is God in everything that's going on at this point now? And it's a good question, because Saul doesn't even go to the Lord in these matters. He takes them into his own hands. It takes a wicked priest who is just as incompetent as Saul at this point, from the cursed and wicked line of Phinehas, to remind Saul of this very thing, of what he should do. Saul wants to go and attack the Philistines. And in verse 36 it says, "Then Saul said, 'Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until morning light, and let us not leave a man of them.' People said, 'Do whatever seems good to you.' But the priest says, 'Let us draw near to God here.'" So we're going to move into our last section of verses here, verses 36 through 46. And we see the silence of God and the vindication of Jonathan at this point. So the priest tells Saul to go and consult the Lord. And so Saul does that. He goes and consults the Lord, and he asks the Lord, "What shall I do? Shall I go and attack the Philistines?" But you know, God remains silent at this point. Saul doesn't hear a word from the Lord. And the reason that I believe is because Saul's not truly seeking God for what God wants Saul to do. Saul is seeking the Lord so God would be Santa Claus to fulfill his own desires. That's what Saul is doing. He doesn't truly want to seek God for the object of his desires. He just wants God to be the one to fulfill them. You know, even James touches on this in chapter 4. When he's talking about, where do quarrels and fights come among you? Is it not this, that your desires are raging war within you? And he says this, you do not have because you do not ask. And you ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your own passions. It's exactly what Saul is doing here. He has these desires, raging war within him, and he allows these desires to control him rather than submitting them to the Lord and saying, "Lord, this is what I want, but I want what you want in this time." When Christ was headed to the cross, he said, "Lord, may this cup pass from me, but not my will, but yours be done." Christ submitted himself to the Lord, fully committed to do what God was going to ask him to do, which required his life. Saul wanted God to give him vindication over his enemies, and God remained silent at this point, and he rightly assumes that it's because of sin. But unfortunately, Saul does not see that it was his sin that caused the Lord to remain silent in his life. his unbelief and his unfaithfulness. And so for Saul, he blamed his son Jonathan for getting in the way between his desires. He blamed his own son for causing his own desires to not be fulfilled, to the point that he's willing to put to death his own son. It says, starting at the end of verse 27, "But he did not answer him that day. And Saul said, 'Come here, all you leaders of the people, and know and see how this sin has arisen today. For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die.'" You know, ironically, Jonathan is the one that's vindicated, not Saul. And Jonathan's not the one that's seeking out his own vindication. It was given to him by Israel, who stands up on his behalf, which would have been considered an act of rebellion against the king. But Israel finally realizes it was God working through Jonathan to accomplish this victory. Jonathan is innocent at this point. And so they ransom Jonathan out of the hands of his wicked father. It took a whole nation to vindicate Jonathan, and Saul doesn't even realize that it was still at this point his sin that caused this. So, as I said, Jonathan didn't seek his own vindication. It was Israel who rescued Jonathan from the hand of his own father. So, with all of this being said, there's still more to this passage, but we don't have time to walk through it right now. I want to close by summing this chapter up with 3 points of application for us. First, God divinely ordains circumstances in our lives that reveal our inabilities and our weaknesses, so God can reveal His unhindered strength in our lives. Secondly, when these circumstances arise, we have a decision to make. We have a decision to make in those times. And that decision is that we should not take our matters into our own hands as though God's work depends upon us. God's going to accomplish what He wants to desire. Sometimes we let our desires get in the way of God. Not that God is hindered by that, but we're putting our desires first rather than God's. And lastly, let us seek the Lord in His righteousness, and all that God desires will be given to you. So let me go ahead and close in prayer this morning. Heavenly Father, these times of difficulties, Lord, that You put in our lives, whatever situations we're facing, Lord, You're so good. You're still in control and You're still sitting on Your throne. Though everything seems to be going haywire around us, Father, none of it is too big for You. Lord, help me to submit myself to You and not let my desires rule my heart, Lord. Lord, may we all, Lord, seek You and Your righteousness first. Lord, may we put our faith in You, knowing that You are able to accomplish more than what we're asking You to do. And so, Father, and lastly, I thank You for sending Your Son, who worked the greatest salvation in human history, Lord. A salvation that we could not earn on our own, but You gave it to us freely, Lord. And all You require for us is to put our faith in You. In Your Son's name, amen.